The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Northeast Credit Union,
helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of
auto, home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you
to discover the difference at
necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system,
improving the health of our communities for years to come.
Information at
imagine.d-h.org.
Word of mouth.
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 Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. That's local footage from the Savar Rana Plaza building collapse in Bangladesh in 2013, a tragedy that prompted international outrage over horrible conditions in clothing factories. More than 1,100 people were killed when several shoddily built stories of sweatshops crumbled. A series of reports followed, calculating the human price of fast, cheap fashion. The deadly cost of new clothes. Your fashion is killing us, came the accusations against shoppers and retailers who overlooked working conditions, which amounted to modern-day slavery. Well, fashion has been killing people for a long time, not only the makers, but the adorned. From lung-puncturing corsets to mercury-tainted top hats to combustible crinolines. Allison Matthews-David details the bizarre, frequently macabre toll of clothing in her book, Fashion Victims, Dangers of Dress, Past and Present. She's Associate Professor of Fashion at Ryerson University in Toronto. And Allison, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you.
You cover so much in this book, from Greek myth to radioactive belts sold on the internet. There's the long history of clothing intended to kill and not to kill. But let's start with the first, when clothing was used as a murder weapon. What are some cases?
One of the things about clothing that I just should preface this by saying is that clothing is something that we think of as keeping us warm, as protecting us, as hopefully making us more beautiful. But often clothing, because it's next to our bodies and because it touches our skin, it can also become a kind of insidious murder weapon. There are legends, certainly, of poisoned garments in many cultures. In India, poisoned robes that were given as gifts from rulers, but, you know, potentially killed off enemies. There was the cloak of Nessus, the famous cloak that killed the hero Hercules. It was tainted with poisoned blood from a serpent. So those are the legends. But as history went on, people started to understand that you could actually use poison chemistry, things like arsenic or mercury or lead, to actually deliberately poison people through their clothing.
Now, your book really focuses on the 19th and early 20th century. Why that time in particular?
Well, that was an important time, a real shift, cultural shift after the Age of the Enlightenment, because what happens is that historically the church had seen fashion as embodying the sin of vanity or pride, and so it was a danger to your immortal soul to sort of focus too much on your dress or your appearance. That was considered vain or prideful. But as medicine improved and as ideas shifted, people started to look increasingly towards fashion as a danger for the physical body.
And sometimes this was a very public spectacle, at least in the case that you document among 19th century dancers and ballerinas. What was going on there?
In 1809, a man called John Heathcote invented a machine to weave a fabric that we would now call tulle. And it made this beautiful, diaphanous, light white fabric that had previously been a luxury fabric and made by hand. And it became a fashion rage because it looked beautiful in the new type of lighting, gas lighting. And on the stage in particular, which was lit by gaslight, ballerinas, you know, that kind of aesthetic of the beautiful romantic ballerina flitting around on stage en pointe, that was part of this new 19th century beauty ideal. And women wore it as well over their crinolines, but it was an incredible fire hazard. So you can imagine just how fast these fabrics could just catch on a gaslight. And one of the most famous incidents was Emma Livry, a prima ballerina at the Paris Opera. Her tutu caught on fire on a gas wing lamp. She ran across the stage and was horribly burnt. And there was nothing to protect her. And she died 8 months later.
Mm. Well, the story of fashion, it can be very gruesome, but it's also in many ways a story of class. I mean, Whereas we think, you know, of the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire or these other kind of tragedies in making fashion, it was often the aristocrats, the hoi polloi, who were victims of fashion excesses. Well, what are some cases of that?
Well, certainly, and that's kind of what I try to emphasize. It was across the social spectrum. So something like the crinoline, which you might know in the U.S. more as the hoop skirt, these sort of metal hoops that would widen a woman's skirt in the 1850s and 60s, those were worn by everyone from duchesses to cooks. So we kind of can guess the hazard for the cook, but one of the other incidents was a young Prussian archduchess. She was 18, and she was smoking when her strict father came in. She tried to hide the cigarette behind her back, and she caught on fire as well. And these objects traveled. For example, the arsenic that affected women making the leaves for artificial flowers, then the women wearing them as headdresses for the ball or green emerald green gowns, these beautiful gowns, they were both affected by these toxins. The making and the wearing, the same objects traveled across social classes.
There's an illustration. There are loads of fantastic illustrations, by the way, in this book. One from 1863. It's called The Ghost in the Looking Glass. And it's a woman, you know, wearing this beautiful dress. And she's looking in the mirror and she can see right behind her, you know, this young woman slumped, you know, looking half starved, slumped against the wall behind her. There are many of these cases of industrial poisoning and accidents. Was there any sense that the upper crust was actually aware or concerned about what went into their fancy dresses and hats?
There is great evidence, actually. I think that's one of the reasons I'm so fascinated by the Victorians, is that there really was that awareness. And that illustration, which I find particularly poignant, it's called The Haunted Lady. She's haunted by the ghost of the seamstress who died making her dress. And so there was a real understanding that your finery could be secured at the cost of someone else's.
We're talking about the drop-dead history of fashion with Allison Matthews-David. She's a professor of fashion who's done some exhaustive research on the often grisly history and hazards of manufacturing and wearing clothing. Her book is called Fashion Victims. Well, we talked about taking out enemies with poison clothing a little bit, but there's also this misbegotten early case of what you call germ warfare. DNA evidence has revealed that during the War of 1812, thousands of soldiers were not killed on the battlefield, but from their uniforms. What was going on?
Well, that's another really interesting example of fashion victims not just being sort of the elite female consumer who's shopped till she's dropped, but really very much affecting everyone. And in particular, in the 19th century, we take our washing machines for granted. But if you were a soldier on campaign or a sailor on a ship or in a prison, you couldn't really launder your uniform. And so what you could get was you could easily get body lice, which are in American soldier, First World War soldier slang, were called cooties. So if you have the cooties, you have not head lice, but lice that would hide in the seams of your clothing, and they would attach themselves to the seams of your clothing, and at night they'd come out and bite you and scratch you, and they could give you a potentially deadly disease called typhus, a really horrific disease. It killed a lot of Napoleon's troops on the retreat from Russia.
It is really hard to believe, and these dangers, you know, lurking in clothing that cover and comfort us. You quote George Bernard Shaw, the writer, joking about the dangers said to be lurking in his clothing. What was that all about?
I love that letter.
What did he say?
He was a lifelong sort of vegetarian and, you know, kind of an early, almost hippie in a way. So he wore these new sanitary garments that were marketed because of all these sorts of scandals that were happening in the 1860s with new dyes that were introduced that were causing skin burns and all sorts of problems. So, you know, there was a whole scandal around poison socks. There were people like Gustav Jaeger, who Jaeger still exists as a fashion brand, but Jaeger marketed these sort of undyed woolen undergarments. And Shaw, he purchased those and he wore them, but he kind of jokingly says, my shirt is going to be my shroud, you know, now that I'm not, you know, I need to wear your clothing, and sort of joking about this new medical kind of language that said, you know, wear these healthy, like the idea of healthy clothing, because fashionable clothing was so unhealthy.
Well, the judgment and the snobbery about the fashion victim, the shopaholic, you know, maybe now today it would be teetering on ridiculously high shoes or taking those little mincing steps in a tight pencil skirt.
Mm-hmm.
But there were few insults quite as acid as Gertrude Stein when she heard about the death of Isadora Duncan. Now, remind us what happened to Isadora Duncan.
Oh, my. Isadora, again, one of the most famous fashion victims, the American dancer, when in the late 1920s, she was going on a pleasure ride in a convertible car in Nice on the French Riviera, and one of her friends had given her a long, beautiful red fringed shawl, and then when the car drove off, she was sitting behind the chauffeur, and the fringes of the shawl caught in the kind of bicycle-like spokes of the convertible and strangled her instantly. Mm. You know, the headline in the New York Times was, you know, Isadora Duncan affecting, as usual, her long trailing shawls, and Gertrude Stein sort of wrote, affectations can be dangerous.
Well, long scarf syndrome was an actual syndrome. It was an actual medical condition, as was a short run of flaming gypsy skirts. Now, these were made fashionable by Sienna Miller in 2004. So, you know, 1924, 2004, this is not over yet.
No, it's not. And in fact, there's still an issue with, as countries become mechanized, and transportation in particular, cars, ski lifts were a problem with scarves, as you can imagine. Playground equipment, bus doors, children getting caught in those. I mean, clothing is a serious risk of entanglement, and doctors have looked into this. But in countries like Pakistan, where shawls or scarves are worn, for example, when you're sitting on a motorcycle side saddle, in a way, those can also get entangled in wheels.
Well, after the Rana Plaza collapse, the conversation turned from blaming retailers, you know, from Benetton to Walmart and others who contracted there, to shoppers. Do you think that's fair? I mean, you're a professor of fashion, presumably teaching designers who are going to make the next generation of clothes to seduce us.
Yes. I don't think it's fair just to kind of focus only on the consumer. It's a problem that is so complex that I think it has to be dealt with on every level, including as an educator, getting people to think about the human issues and about the sort of ethics and sustainability of fashion from the start. I think we're trying to do that. We have a new Fashion Research Center for Diversity and Social Change. I mean, fashion has this seductive power, but why not use it for good? Why not seduce people towards buying more ethically produced or sustainable or fair trade garments?
And how do you dress or shop? Or nary a platform shoe or cheap fashion purchase for you?
You know, I wish I could say that. I am more careful. Since I have been writing this book, I try to buy things by local designers and more ethically sourced, but it's almost unavoidable. What do you do for your socks? What do you do for... It's difficult, and I'm kind of a white, middle-aged, privileged consumer, so I can consume these things if I spend the time, but I think the whole system has to change so that these things are much more readily available and attractive. You know, I had my mom's dress-up closet, so I had beautiful, you know, shirts that she had made of Liberty Lawn cotton. But I think it's difficult because we're dealing with a generation coming through now who have never known anything but fast fashion, who have never, have never felt a nice textile in some ways. They might not know what those things look and feel like and how to design for those fabrics. We have these collections of garments that were made, you know, in the past. Fabric was valuable and people kept it until it became a quilt, until it became, you know, something like that. And I think with the crafting movement, I mean, there is hope for sort of looking at historical garments, which my contemporary students do. I think that the past still has lessons to teach us.
Allison Matthews David, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Allison is Associate Professor of Fashion at Ryerson University. That's in Toronto. And there's much more on her book, Fashion Victims, Dangers of Dress Past and Present. There's a link at wordofmouthradio.org. The Statue of Liberty is arguably America's most iconic monument and a symbol of refuge and freedom for the tired, poor, and huddled masses. But that was not always the case. This piece comes to us from Backstory in the American History Guys and producer Jess Engerbretson.
It all started in 1865 at a French dinner party near Versailles. The guests, mostly intellectuals and artists, were not fond of the current French government, a repressive regime headed by Emperor Napoleon III. They wanted to find some way to celebrate the values important to them.
We're talking about, you know, liberal values.
This is Peter Scarry, a political scientist at Boston College.
Individual rights, the importance of freedom of the press, freedom of speech.
Those values were not flourishing in France. But they did seem to be flourishing in the U.S., which had just abolished slavery. And so the dinner guests dreamed up a grand gesture that would help connect France to the American story of expanding freedoms. A Statue of Liberty, lifting a torch and crushing a broken chain beneath her feet. It would be a gift from French citizens to the U.S., representing Franco-American friendship, the expansion of liberties in both countries, and the hope for world peace. But one thing it wouldn't represent was immigration.
The notion of the United States as a refuge or a goal for migrants wasn't part of what the French liberals had in mind at all.
Nor were Americans particularly pushing the idea of U.S. as refuge. By the time the statue was finally inaugurated, 20 years had passed. It was the fall of 1886, and Americans were feeling decidedly skeptical about immigration. That spring, the Haymarket bombing in Chicago had killed 11 people and injured dozens more. The actual bomb thrower was never identified, but 8 men were convicted for conspiracy. 6 of them were immigrants. So 5 months later, at the Statue of Liberty's inaugural festivities, Haymarket was still on many Americans' minds. The main speaker made sure to emphasize that the U.S. was only interested in welcoming some immigrants.
There is room in America and brotherhood for all who will support our institutions and aid in our development. But those who come to disturb our peace and dethrone our laws are aliens and enemies forever.
3 years later, the editor of the Atlantic Monthly wrote a similarly anxious poem about the statue. Its title, Unguarded Gates.
O Liberty, white goddess, is it well to leave the gates unguarded? On thy breast fold sorrow's children, soothe the hurts of fate. Lift the downtrodden, but with hand of steel, stay those who to the sacred portals come to waste the gifts of freedom. Have a care.
Of course, today there's another poem associated with the Statue of Liberty.
Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free.
This sonnet was written by Emma Lazarus to commemorate the plight of Jewish refugees fleeing violence in Russia. It was auctioned off to help support the Statue of Liberty's installation. But it didn't have a direct connection to the statue until 17 years later, when a friend of Lazarus had a plaque made.
And that plaque is put in some relatively obscure place on the inside of the pedestal in 1903. And there it sits for several decades, relatively unnoted.
During those decades, immigration to the U.S. plummeted. A new quota system introduced in 1924 sharply limited admission from what many believed to be undesirable groups: Asians, Jews, Southeastern Europeans. But meanwhile, Lady Liberty was as popular as ever.
On the 50th anniversary of the statue, which would have been 1936, Franklin Delano Roosevelt came to celebrate that 50th anniversary, and nothing was mentioned about Emma Lazarus's sonnet, and nothing was mentioned about immigration or refugees.
But around the same time, some people were starting to connect the statue with immigration, and with refugees in particular. One of them was a journalist named Louis Adamek, who wrote books with names like America and the Refugees. He was especially concerned about the rise of Nazism in Germany and argued that the U.S. should admit many more Jewish refugees. But in 1939, a bill that would have allowed an additional 20,000 German Jewish children into the country died in committee. The same year, a Fortune magazine poll suggested that 83% of Americans favored retaining the limits on immigration. It wasn't until after the war that Adamek's position became mainstream. Footage of U.S. troops liberating Nazi concentration camps reinforced many Americans' sense that their country was on the side of freedom. But it also raised troubling questions about the U.S. government's resistance to admitting refugees before the war. That blend of pride and uneasiness led many to embrace a new, more welcoming version of liberty.
In 1945, the bronze tablet with the Emma Lazarus sonnet on it that had been inside the pedestal in a rather obscure place was removed and put outside in a prominent place beside the main entrance to the statue.
The move solidified the association between immigration and the statue. Lady Liberty was no longer the white goddess. Instead, she was the mother of exiles. And in 1965, the restrictive quota system was replaced by a new law, the baseline for current immigration policy. When President Lyndon B. Johnson signed that bill into law, he did so where else? At the Statue of Liberty.
Over my shoulders here, you can see Ellis Island, whose vacant corridors echo today the joyous sound of long ago voices. And today we can all believe that the lamp of this grand old lady is brighter today, and the golden door that she guards gleams more brilliantly in the light of an increased liberty for the people.
That story was brought to us by Backstory with the American History Guys and producer Jess Engebretson. You'll find a link to more episodes at our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. As a kid, you probably played Exquisite Corpse, whether you called it that or not. But to refresh your memory, you fold a piece of paper in thirds and one person draws a head down to the neck. Without looking, someone else draws neck to waist, and another draws the rest. Then the paper is unfolded, and the mismatched body is revealed to the delight of all. Well, what you may not know is that you were playing a game devised by the French poet and writer André Breton in the 1920s at the height of the Surrealist movement. It is just one of many games the Surrealists played, and you can too, at 3S Art Space in Portsmouth on Thursday. Leading the games, Roger Miller, one of the founders of the influential punk band Mission of Burma and of the Alloy Orchestra. That's an experimental ensemble that provides live scores to silent films. He's also a writer and visual artist. And Roger Miller, I'm so pleased to welcome you to Word of Mouth.
Well, thank you very much, Virginia. I'm very happy to be talking with you.
Well, we called this game Exquisite Corpse. Other people said that they played Exquisite Corpse with words. Now, where did this all come from?
When the Surrealists started becoming active in the early 20s, one of their main goals was to resolve the previously contradictory conditions of dream and reality. So to that end, they did a lot of games that were designed to bring things together that didn't necessarily fit together correctly, which is how dreams function a lot. A very famous sentence by the patron saint of Surrealism, the Comte de La Tremont, or his real name was Isadora Lucienne de Casse, sums it up. The chance meeting on a dissecting table of a sewing machine and an umbrella. Now that sentence combines three elements that do not belong together: dissecting table, sewing machine, umbrella. But when you put them together, at least my mind immediately conjures up an image, and you start making associations, which the human mind will do. The human mind will create meaning out of these things, and that is very much a dreamlike meaning.
So these Surrealists actually got together, you know, I'm thinking Breton and Magritte, you know, sitting around and playing these kind of crazy disassociative games?
Yes, they did. If you have any books on Surrealism, you'll see a lot of these Exquisite Corpse drawings, primarily the drawings, because once Surrealism became less of a goal of poetry and more of a visual goal, which is what most of us know it as, then the drawing games became more important. And I've seen them with, you know, Man Ray, Duchamp, Max Ernst, you know, Breton, Tanguy, all my favorite guys, you know, playing together, and some of my favorite gals as well.
So what are some of the other games that Surrealists played?
Well, there's that drawing game, the Exquisite Corpse, and I encourage people to not necessarily treat it just as, you know, a head, a torso, and a leg, but the legs could be a tree, the torso could be, you know, planets in outer space. This increases the dreamlike quality. There's quite a few word games. The very first game that the Surrealists created, which generated the phrase Exquisite Corpse, is that they would take a sentence, break it down to adjective, noun, adverb, verb, adjective, noun. And the first person would write an adjective, fold the paper back. The next person would write a noun, fold the paper back, until you've got the six words and you have a sentence. And the very first sentence that they created this way was, "The exquisite corpse shall drink the new wine." And that's where the phrase "the exquisite corpse" comes from.
So you're going to be the master of ceremonies for this game playing at 3S Art Space. What is your role in all of this?
I have a PowerPoint that is explaining the games and projecting them on a screen the entire time. But also on the table, there are the rules to the various games. And my job is to go around and explain a new game when people want a new game.
So that's so funny to me that Surrealists had rules.
Well, you have to have rules. There's a very famous, one of my favorite I Ching hexagrams is called limitation, because without some sort of limitation, the world is infinite and it just explodes. You know, you need something to contain a situation. And so these rules contain a situation and then allow that dreamlike activity to happen.
So have you ever been the master of ceremonies with a live group like this before?
Oh, yeah. I've done it at the ICA in Boston, Mass MoCA, Real Art Ways. And I've done it with my friends, you know, not infinite amount of times, but hundreds, let's just say.
So how does it work with a big group?
It's great. What the situation is always set up so that there are many tables, and the ideal amount of people per table is between 3 and 6. And these people get together, usually just by chance. It's a nice chance operation from the very beginning. You know, a couple will come, they'll sit in a table, 2 other people will come, I'll say, "Why don't you sit down over there?" And they've never met each other before, and then they start playing the games. What really I find so beautiful about this is that I have come across people, and they've been sitting at tables, like, "Oh, you guys must know each other, you know, you guys are look like your friends." And they said, "Oh, no, we just met each other 15 minutes ago."
It's so interesting. I mean, this is something we used to play as kids, right? Mm-hmm. And why do we stop? I love this idea that surrealists continue with this kind of silliness. I mean, it's not something that you don't hear of abstract expressionist games, do you? What do the surrealists mean to you, and why do they play?
I mean, there's something about surrealism that it sometimes gets knocked by some serious artists. They don't take it surrealism as serious as I do. What I like about surrealism is it's not one thing that's really important about it. It's not a style. It's an attitude. You know, if you look at 2 different surrealist artwork, they look completely different, or the writers. What I find so appealing about these games is that anybody can play. I've had people walk in and say, "Well, you know, I don't know how to draw." And I go, "It doesn't matter. Because if you have 3 people at a table and one person is a great artist and wants to prove they're a great artist, if they draw a head, you know, the upper part of a drawing that's excellently executed, but if it doesn't attach in an intuitive way to the middle part, then the drawing is not important." So it's not about the individual, it's about the collective. And that's what makes these games, to me, so amazing.
How do people respond to you doing this, though? I mean, you still tour with Mission of Burma. This is a band that so many have cited as influential to them. Nirvana, the Pixies, REM, Sonic Youth. So, I don't know, it may be kind of surreal that you host these kind of things, right?
I've had some friends make some funny comments. It's like I'm a psychedelic Dick Cavett. That's one way it was described by some people that are more my age. When I'm doing the Surrealist Games, my job is to be the Surrealist Games host. And if someone wants to talk to me about Mission of Burma, that's fine. But I'm there to be the Surrealist Games host and facilitate everybody to have this experience of, even if they don't think they're creative, that they will create something. And when they open up the paper at the end of the games, the word games or the drawing games, everybody, I guarantee, will be just like, you know, laughing. And sometimes these things are not just funny. They actually have a sense of profundity.
Well, Roger Miller, thank you so much for joining us, and have fun on Thursday.
I certainly will. And I know that everybody else who shows up also will have fun.
Roger Miller, he's a founder of the influential post-punk band Mission of Burma and Alloy Orchestra. And he's leading an evening of surrealist games on Thursday at 3S Art Space in Portsmouth. And of course, being a seasoned musician, he's got a soundtrack in mind. Here's just a sample of some of the music that Roger plans to play. ¶¶ music chosen by Roger Miller, musician, artist, and MC of an evening of surrealist games at 3S Art Space on Thursday. There's more information at wordofmouthradio.org. And after the break, the enigmatic musician and artist Bjork. Cerebral, raw, and unafraid. That's after the break when Word of Mouth continues. Before the break, we talked about the overlap between rock and roll and surrealism. Now to a musician and composer whose work has been described as surreal, among other things. Rishikesh Hirway is creator of the Song Exploder podcast. In this episode, delving into Stonemaker. It's a song from Bjork's 2015 album, Volnakura.
It's about someone who's trying to get emotions out of another person. The whole song is emotionally about wanting clarity, wanting simplicity, and talking to someone who wants things to be really complex and foggy and unclear. And you're saying, okay, I've got clarity, so, you know, want it or not. So it's like sort of celebrating simplicity and clarity. I was walking on a beach and I was kind of walking back and forth, and the lyrics kind of came along, kind of without me really editing them. The strength of this album really is just simplicity and, you know, this kind of like thinking out loud feeling. And I shouldn't be too clever. It would work against it. So I kind of just went with the first words that actually came.
Moments of clarity are so rare. I better document this.
Probably the most obvious lyrics I've ever written. I actually wrote a whole nother lyric to the song, which was really maybe a bit too clever for its own good. But something in me just said, no, don't touch it. It has to be like almost clumsy or naive. That's sort of the strength and the weakness of the song at the same time.
I wish to synchronize our feelings, our feelings. Ooh, oh, show some emotion.
I'm mostly a singer, but I think the way I sing, I usually wait for a day where I'm kind of probably more impulsive than other days in one way or another. So when I sing, I'll go to this place where it's more similar to when I'm doing a concert. I will not have so much of my brain in there. I'll just like warm up my voice, have a coffee, and I'll just jump in the deep end where you're more a performer. But I think more and more, ever since I got my laptop 15 years ago, probably the biggest part of me as a musician is the editor. I probably spend like 90% of my time making music, editing. You know, if it's editing vocals, editing beats, editing instruments. I think that's a very big part of my work now. So that's also another side.
Who can share and who has shut down the chances?
That sentence is there and the reverb is cut there just to show, you know, what happens if you are closed. If you cut down chances, it's a certain closing a door there. And sometimes you show sonically something emotional.
Who has shut down the chances?
The melody is so simple and the words are so simple. I actually waited for the right microphone because it had to be really like that you hear every detail in the voice. So it's like a really high definition human that's there. After I'd written the songs and I was starting working on the beats, I met Alejandro, Arca. And it was a magical relationship. And he was obviously so talented. So I decided to take a back step and for it to be a handshake between me and him. We sat next to each other and we talked about every single thing because I'd already written all the songs. With Stone Milker, it was very obvious that that song is very simple. So we didn't really need a crazy beat thing going on. It just had to be really supportive of the song and almost acoustic, like it's a symphony orchestra playing and the beat would come from the kettle drum or something, you know, like just a very soft support, which Alejandro provided. So I would sit down at a keyboard and just work out the chords. And then when I'm ready with the chord structure, because I knew it would be for strings, I would take it to violins, violas, cellos, because I kind of wanted a lot of it to be in the strings. We actually saved it till last, and I did several days of recording the strings, I had 30 players. And then I would do two sets of arrangements. So basically they are in theory 60, because it needed that sort of panoramic feeling to have that sort of smooth, cream-like perfection. For me, it was very important with Stone Milker that the strings were kind of cyclical, this chord cycle that kind of gives you this feeling it can go on and on in circles and gives you this feeling of equilibrium, like the person who's singing the song is showing some sort of harmony to someone as an example. I layered several recordings of the strings to be like a tower of equilibrium that you are standing in, like a monument of equilibrium. And you're standing in the middle of it and you're small and it's huge and it just goes circle and circle and you feel very safe and secure. And that's sort of the clarity that I would want to offer, try to offer emotionally in the song. And the strings are kind of the tool I have to try to make this kind of cradle. So I spent a lot of time going through all the takes and all the mics and try to make this kind of tight woven net that each string instrument was equally important because they have all these kind of sub-melodies that they would, you could hear them all, but it would still not be a solo, that it was like this balance of this kind of woven string tower that was keeping you safe. Because there was so much work and so much about the textures in the strings that I thought it deserved a version where the beats are not shadowing the string textures, that there was another version would exist and that I would get not just the strings functioning as a whole, but also have solo violins to do more and to kind of indulge more in the microphone textures. Also, I think it's a question of, like, tempo. Like, I feel the main version of Willy Cura has more drive. You know, the beats obviously give it more energy. But I felt there was another version of Willy Cura with just the strings where it's more slower pace, you know, more like you reading a book at home, you know, like lying outside in the moss looking at the sky. Thank you. I think, Stonemilker, it's a one big question, really. You're asking someone a question, suggesting something, but you don't want to push too hard, trying to, in the most harmonious way possible, trying to prove a point. So it's sort of a very gentle suggestion, because I think staying emotionally open, it's a choice, you know? I think it's equally hard for all of us, and we're just all doing our best, but I think there's also a choice, you know? Do you want to try and then maybe fail half of the time and then succeed half of the time or whatever your odds are? Or is it your choice to not even try?
And now, here's Stonemilker by Björk.
To hear more episodes, subscribe to Song Exploder on iTunes. And while you're there, subscribe to our brand new podcast, The 10-Minute Writer's Workshop, where I sit down with great writers to talk about how they conjure and craft their work and find out what it really takes to get pen to paper, finger to keyboard. We're so grateful for your listening time today and want you to know there's much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. I'm Virginia Prescott, and we'll be back tomorrow, too, with more Word of Mouth from NHPR.